Start out with any preliminary questions or issues, housekeeping matters. Before we do that, let me just see if there are any housekeeping yes, Susan.
The time again that you're going to grade that exam?
4 o'clock on Monday. Well, if you can make that, I think it's worthwhile. I'm going to film it, but if you can't make it at 4, if that's inconvenient, you can catch it later, but any other housekeeping, logistical questions? Mr. McKnight, what was your
question? In the class, you were given three burdens, three negatives, right? Well, the case...
I actually wouldn't put it as three burdens, but three issues to consider.
Okay. Were you using the Nettleton case?
Yes.
And these were the three issues that the Nettleton case offered. The first two were the same that you wrote on the board, but the third one was different. The third one you claimed was one if the violation was unexcused. And the Nettleton case says the third one is the plaintiff must be a member of the class of persons the ordinance was designed to accept.
Okay, good question. What I think I said in class yesterday was that when I put that second element, if you will, or burden, namely that the statute was intended to cover accidents like this, I include both that it's the type of thing. In other words, the statute says you can't have a billboard any closer than 50 feet from the center of the roadway. Was that designed to protect the environment and make it more beautiful, or was that designed to reduce accidents from cars drifting off the highway and hitting billboards? The one the court treats as the third issue is, and was the plaintiff within the class of people the statute was designed to protect? Was it designed to protect highway workers? Was it designed to protect motorists? That's, sort of collapse those all together to say, is this sort of pure happenstance that the guy happened to violate the statute, but it's really not germane to what the statute was all about? Or is this precisely, or at least arguably, within the range of things the statute was designed to prevent? Now, I added an additional element that the court doesn't list, which technically is not part of the plaintiff's burden of proof. It's actually what the defendant would raise potentially by way of avoidance of the issue. Namely, well, maybe I violated the statute, but I have an excuse. So in Nettleton, maybe I violated the statute. Maybe the statute was designed to prevent people falling downstairs. But there's a third reason why you may not be able to do negligence per se in terms of getting where you want to go, to have the conclusion drawn that the defendant was negligent. You may be unable to get there because the defendant has an excuse. So it's an important illustration of the way in which what you read in a summary of a case or in authority about the elements of res ipsa loquitur, for example, and how does it go 1, 2, 3, or 1, 3, 2? Are there four elements? Are there three? Duty, breach, causation, damages. I often give you a slightly different version of it, same basic substance, but for my own tastes, I find it helpful to modify it in certain ways. Your job as a student is made more difficult because you get sort of conflicting advice from different people. Well, I thought these were the three elements. No, those are the three elements. And again, one of the things you want to do is kind of look for differences in verbiage, but the same substance. You say tomato, I say tomato. Or whether it's something where there's really a substantive difference. Some people include this, some people don't, and it makes a difference whether or not that is included or not. So again, while the court's correct in saying you have to have both a statutory violation and you have to show that the statute was designed to prevent injuries like this to the plaintiff, I would say there's something else you've got to consider, which is whether the violation might be excused. But a good point about just sort of keeping track, don't be too oblivious to differences in the way these tests are stated, but see if you can kind of look to see whether there's just a difference in verbiage or whether there's really a difference in substance, and questions like that help to illustrate, to raise them and then be more precise. Other preliminary questions? Mr. Sarkis. Yes. To the extent that the, again, there's kind of a division of labor between the trial courts and the appellate courts. The trial courts are primarily designed to resolve disputed issues of fact. So you take witness, you take testimony from witnesses, you introduce exhibits, documents, and other relevant material to try to find out, was the light red or was the light green? Is this the defendant's signature on this contract? Was there, a timely objection made to some, whatever. All of those sort of factual details are the things that trial courts are designed to do. And they have sort of, in a way, they have more generous resources in the sense you can spend 2 weeks listening to witnesses and have them cross-examined and so forth. Once you get up to the appellate court's specialty is what the law is. What are the elements of a race that's a looker? And exactly how do you define exclusive control as in the elevator case? That's what they're good at. And once they clarify that, for example, in Cardozo's opinion, it wasn't for the jury to dispense with the requirement to have a light on your buggy at night, having decided that that is the law, ordinarily the appellate court is in a tough spot in terms of then resolving the factual issues. So to the extent, for example, we don't know whether the lack of light on the buggy made a difference, was a cause without which the injury would not have occurred, ordinarily we would say, gee, as sitting here in an appellate court, I could go back and read the testimony and sort of play trial court, but a lot of what we expect out of a trial, the opportunity to see the demeanor of the witness, to really get a much more on-the-ground feel for it. And then there may be disputed issues of fact where, again, we like the idea that our fate is in the hands of 12 people like us, supposedly, rather than a group of, platonic guardians up there who impose things upon us without any, sort of direct contact with the day-to-day life. Now, again, not every legal system in the world places as much importance on the role of the jury, but ours does. And to the extent that that's a value that we've adopted, then the appellate court is not wasting our time by making us do this again, but is sort of affirming the value of what comes out of it. Oftentimes, after a case has been decided at the appellate court level, rather than actually retry the case, the parties frequently can settle. They've actually heard the testimony. They're pretty good at guesstimating, okay, based on that testimony, I'm willing to take half of what I demanded, or I'll offer you 40% of what the jury awarded, rather than face the jury again. One of the things that prevents settlement from occurring is that you get different perspectives on what a case is worth. I've been listening to my client, and I'm all fired up for my client's version of things. The opponent listens to their client, gets all fired up for their client's version of things. Everybody has sort of a false sense of confidence. You get to trial, you hear the witnesses, it's all kind of there in black and white, and it's a lot easier at that point to say, you know, I still like my client, I still think my client's got the better end of this, but I can see the real problems that came out, and now you can arrive at a more precise evaluation of what the case is worth. So lots of cases settle after the appellate court has made its decision about what the law is. Okay. Res ipsa loquitur. Again, just to place us in the big scheme of things, we've been looking at different techniques or methods of establishing negligence, appealing to the jury's own experience, or looking to industry custom, or using some violation of statute to establish negligence. The next place we look at is cases in which we don't really know what happened, but we're making an intelligent guess. And so our first case along these lines is Judson versus Giant Powder Company. Ms. Solovchev, can you tell us about Judson? As the court put it, none was left to tell the tale. Okay? So, a classic kind of res ipsa loquitur case where the plaintiff would like us to make an intelligent guess. What does the court say?
Well, the court gave the plaintiff the damages of over $41,000 for acts of negligence.
Now, did the plaintiff actually prove negligence? And again, this sort of raises the question, is it true that the plaintiff must prove negligence ordinarily to recover? And the answer is yes. Ordinarily, the plaintiff does have to prove. We do have some cases in which strict liability is involved, but this is a case in which it was assumed that the plaintiff couldn't recover unless the plaintiff proved negligence. Did the plaintiff do that? How?
Well, the plaintiff offered no evidence showing explosion.
Okay. Now, one of the first questions we need to ask is, what do we mean by proving negligence? One way of proving negligence is offering, when we say prove, we don't mean to a metaphysical certainty. When we prove that the defendant was negligent in swatting the wasp, we don't mean we're absolutely 100% sure. We only mean in a civil case, in a torts case, more probably than not. If we're, sort of undecided about it, if we're sort of leaning in one direction a little, but I'm more inclined to say the defendant was negligent than to say the defendant wasn't negligent, that's sufficient in a civil case. It's not enough to put you in jail for a criminal offense, for that kind of exertion of government power. We require that the government prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. But if it's simply taking the defendant's property and giving it to the plaintiff, as compared to letting the plaintiff suffer the injury without compensation, in deciding which of those two options we pick, all we expect of the plaintiff is to satisfy us more probably than not. Now, as you say, the plaintiff didn't have any evidence in the form of no one saw a defendant lighting a cigar right next to the black powder magazine. We don't have any of the classic signs, skid marks, the things whereby we can identify what happened. So how is it that the plaintiff proved that the defendant was negligent?
He had witnesses and testified that the employee was
conducting the
test as
you're
supposed to.
Okay, we kind of do this in reverse. We basically say, what do we know about dynamite factories? What we know is that a well-run dynamite factory doesn't just spontaneously blow up. A well-run dynamite factory has various kinds of safeguards built in, and from our experience, those times when dynamite factories have blown up and we know what the cause is, in the vast majority of those cases, they're a result of negligence. Somebody didn't follow the procedure. Somebody was careless. That's what causes most dynamite factories to blow up. Since this one did blow up, we run the logic the other way and say, therefore, we have a pretty good idea that this one probably was the result of negligence. We're not saying that 100% certainty. There are cases in which, you know, there's some freak lightning storm or a meteor hits the dynamite factory, or there's some other external cause not traceable to the defendant's negligence, but that's fairly rare. An example we have, for example, it would be an airline crash. Why do airlines crash into the ground? Well, that's in some ways a bad example because as a result of flight data recorders and, you know, all this kind of stuff, we have pretty good records and ways of investigating. We can pinpoint the cause of most disasters. We can pinpoint why the space shuttle, was it Endeavor, whatever, the one that crashed and burned on reentry. We can figure out what caused that. Some, you know, panel damaged the tiles, the heat-resistant tiles on liftoff, whatever. But if we didn't know, in at least, 20% of the cases, of the 80% of the cases where we do know what caused the airline to crash, the overwhelming majority are due to somebody's negligence. Most commonly, some sort of pilot error. Sometimes a mechanical problem. Sometimes, you know, bad weather combined with bad judgment about how to handle the bad weather, etc. So, again, what the plaintiff is asking us to do is to sort of play the odds and say, can't we, from our experience, infer from the way most accidents happen that this probably falls within that category? By that means, I prove negligence according to what we accept as proof. Again, the plaintiff says, I saw the defendant speeding. And the defendant says, I wasn't speeding. And the jury finds them, it's hard to tell who's got the better of that story. On balance, they're more inclined to believe the plaintiff's version that the defendant was speeding than they are to believe the defendant's explanation of how the accident occurred, but the defendant wasn't speeding. Does that prove negligence? Only to the extent of our standard by a preponderance, and that's the one the jury is allowed to use. Okay, so in this case, the court says the plaintiff satisfied our negligence standard, not by direct evidence, but through the use of this logical inference. Now, obviously, the plaintiff would like to use res ipsa wherever there is a shortage of other evidence of negligence. And the defendant would like to push that away. And so the next case of the elevator company gives us a chance to sort of see how it works in action. A very good question. We haven't really covered the burden of proof to establish strict liabilities. It turns out this seems like something. If you've read ahead Siegler versus Kuhlman and succeeding cases, it looks like this falls within it. Part of it is the time frame that we're talking about. You know, this is back in 18 something or other. Yeah, 1895. So, you know, at that point, the law of strict liability is not as well developed. Negligence had a much stronger grip on the imagination of tort lawyers. And it may also be the plaintiff thought, I've got a pretty good shot on negligence here. Assuming I can qualify under this test, it does seem pretty obvious that somebody made a mistake. Now, all the plaintiff gets by way of the res ipsa inference is a chance to have the jury consider it. It doesn't foreclose the defendant from countering the plaintiff's evidence. Suppose, for example, this happens simply south of San Francisco, as I recall. Many years ago, Patty Hearst, the daughter of the newspaper family in California, was kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army, and they had a pretty heyday in the San Francisco, knocking off banks and other things. Suppose the defendant offers evidence that members of the Symbionese Liberation Army were seen driving into the factory shortly before it blew up. Would that be relevant to the question of what caused this to blow up? Absolutely. If the jury says, well, we understand ordinarily dynamite factories don't blow up as a result of negligence and except as a result of negligence, but under these circumstances, the defendant has persuaded us that this is one of those exceptional cases. They were minding their own business running a dynamite factory, and a bunch of terrorists come in and take it over. And they're firing automatic weapons and doing other things, and boom, there it went. You could still ask questions. Well, if we go back again in the airplane analogy, when the Pan Am, I believe it was 007, that was flying from Germany to, I forget where it was headed, but it was blown up over Lockerbie, Scotland. I believe it was Libyan terrorists who blew it up. They put bombs in the luggage, which exploded at a certain altitude or timing, what have you. Was Pan Am liable for that? Were they negligent? We know that the explosion was not a result of pilot error or something else. We might still say that Pan Am was negligent in not screening the baggage. There are other ways to show that even though it was in the act of terrorists, they were negligent in the security they maintained. So, again, the point about res ipsa loquitur is that it keeps the plaintiff from simply being stymied by the fact that we don't know what happened. If we can make a logical inference of negligence through the res ipsa logic, then the plaintiff may get the case to the jury. Mr. Maroney?
Yes, sir. So could you have also argued the res ipsa for the New York firemen in New York? The lack of, they couldn't prove negligence.
Which case was this?
The old lady who had the...
Mrs. Water. Bierman.
Yes.
Actually, Bierman would have been a very good res ipsa case. And, of course, the irony, or one of many ironies of that case, is Mrs. Bierman wouldn't know res ipsa loquitur, you know. She's walking into court telling her story. Now, again, you could have... asked Judge Younger to apply a res ipsa logic to it, but to some extent there too you would wind up in a bit of a contest over what we know about water mains. Can we say that water mains don't ordinarily break and flood the surrounding property unless there has been negligence? Do water mains age over time through earth movement and other kinds of causes? And as we'll see in the elevator case, you also have to show that the defendant had exclusive control. City of New York points to Consolidated Edison. Consolidated Edison points back at the City of New York. No one accepts responsibility for being in control of this thing when it happened. The nice thing in Judson Powder is you have one defendant who is in control. That's not really an issue. So, again, all of these things, thinking about strict liability, thinking about using res ipsa back in the Bierman case, all of these, make sense. Okay, let's talk about the elevator case here because it puts the elements of a res ipsa case in sharper focus. Mr. Trapedi, why don't you tell us about Murphy? Hang on a second. Manufacture the elevator, what's their role in this?
No, they service, maintain or repair them.
Okay.
Stuff like that.
So this is the local service company.
Right.
And they're being blamed for the fact that the elevator malfunctioned.
Right.
Okay? So what happens when she presents this theory at trial?
Basically, she said that in presenting it at trial, she had testimony from some elevator technicians who worked on elevators for a number of years, saying that if the elevators were functioning properly, they don't get across the warranty.
And again, this is one area where you may get into a bit of a dispute. That is, the defendant may produce their own experts to say, look, there are lots of different reasons why elevators don't level properly. You may get spikes in the voltage, it's being supplied, blah, blah, blah. You get into this technical discussion about why do elevators sometimes run out of level. But if the plaintiff has offered relatively persuasive testimony, then indeed we can fairly infer that a misleveled elevator is probably the result of negligence. We haven't foreclosed the defendant from showing that maybe this is one of those exceptions, but at least we're in the ballpark so the jury can use this inference to find that the defendant was negligent. Okay, so let's, again, write the elements of this case. The first element here is that it's the type of accident. And it's phrased in a double negative, which is a little bit confusing. I'll leave that. You could say it's a type of accident that suggests negligence. But the way the test is phrased, it's in a double negative. It's a type of accident that doesn't occur absent negligence. Therefore, if it did occur, we can infer negligence. Okay? So, I want to emphasize this word. It's the type of accident. What we're talking about is elevator misleveling cases. I always get students who are confused about the difference between this element and Chapter 2. In Chapter 2, we talk about the requirement that the plaintiff show us that this accident would not have occurred except for negligence. So again, the issue in Martin versus Herzog, would the buggy have been struck but for the lack of life? But that's a different test. As I say, students regularly get this confused, so I want to see if I can reduce that number by reminding you that what we're talking about is not this accident, but the type of accident, the category into which this falls. Elevator mislevels. What evidence do we, or what experience do we have? Can we say, based on our experience, that accidents like this don't happen in the absence of negligence? Okay, what's the second element in a race ipsa case?
That the defendant, since they were under contract with the hospital.
Actually, before we get to the facts of this case, why don't you give me the traditional test here? What is the second element here?
The injuries were caused by an agency or instrumentality.
Okay, and I'm going to sort of condense that a little bit to say the defendant had exclusive control. Why is that important?
To show that it was under their control so that they would be the only one liable for the...
If we're going to blame the defendant for having been negligent, we have to be reasonably confident that it was the defendant's negligence rather than somebody else's. Even if we can show that water mains don't ordinarily break except when somebody's been negligent, if the defendant says, but how do you know it was us who were the negligent party, it could just as easily have been Con Ed. If that's true, that we don't really know whether it was one or the other, we can hardly use this to say, it must have been your negligence that caused the accident. It may have been somebody's negligence, but unless the defendant had, in the term that he uses, exclusive control, it's a little bit misleading, but that's the term of art here, then it's not fair to use this inference. Let's just get the third element on the table here, and then we'll come back and do the question.
That's a plaintiff. Didn't have any action or anything like that.
Okay, and beyond that, not only was the plaintiff's negligence not the cause of this injury, but
the Roberts.
Okay, that other plausible, I'm going to put it this way, other plausible explanations sufficiently eliminated. Have we done a reasonable job considering other possible explanations and ruled them out? So, for example, the dynamite factory blows up. Have we established there weren't any terrorists in the neighborhood? There was no freak electrical storm? There was no meteor that dropped out of the sky? We can reasonably narrow this case down to the typical cause of accidents like this, which is negligence. So, again, it's a kind of, narrowing process. We're starting out with the idea, in general, things like this are usually the result of negligence. The defendant is the one we should logically blame for it if there was negligence. And we've done a reasonable job eliminating other causes, including the plaintiff's own contributory negligence. So in this case, for example, has the plaintiff satisfied us that she didn't trip over something, she wasn't not looking where she was going, or some other explanations for why this accident occurred. Okay. Now, if that's our test, and again, I'm sure you've been through this in some form or other, this whole idea of IRAC, you know, the issue, rule, application, conclusion. It's a kind of forced way to pursue a legal argument. You identify the issue, can we use res ipsa to establish negligence in this case? Okay, the R in IRAC, what's the rule? And you want to be able to state the rule in a reasonably concise way that's got the guts of it, but is you know, not necessarily in all of its regal splendor. You may find it easier to just memorize the thing, not try to condense it, but you do need to understand it, and the exact form of words is less important than making sure you've got the concept reasonably clear. Okay, so this being the abstract rule, how does that rule, the third part of IRAC, the A in IRAC, how does it apply in this case?
Basically,
let's take each element at a time. First of all, is this the type of accident that doesn't ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence?
According to the facts of the case and the testimony, no. The accident doesn't occur.
Okay, so again, this is where the double negative gets us in trouble. It is true that from this type of accident, we can usually infer negligence. What about, and again, this is not a no-brainer. We needed the plaintiff's expert to convince us, having experience with elevators and why they miss level most of the time, according to this expert, but that's not the place where the defendant is digging in and trying to avoid this. What about element number two?
Well, the elevators were owned by the hospital. Who had a contract with the service company from the elevator company. So, I would say that the exclusion control, that the defendant did not have exclusion control because they were on contract and only visited the hospital.
What did the court say?
They agreed.
Yeah. The court, and actually, I'm not sure we ever did the procedural history. What happened in the case at trial?
Judgment was for the defendant.
And what happened when the plaintiff tried to use res ipsa to prove negligence?
They said that the court said that that didn't apply because of
it. The trial court said that? Yes, they did. Hey, in one sense, it's unimportant because we know what we want is where did the appellate court wind up on that issue, but sometimes these questions are discretionary. It's something where the trial judge is given some leeway. On this point, it's actually an issue of law, but the trial judge said, you know, I don't think you've satisfied these elements. You haven't met the second element of exclusive control. And the appellate court, as you said, agreed with that. To say, no, the hospital had enough control. If you had to pick one or the other, you would say it seems to fall more within the area of the elevator company's service contract. If you had to pick one of the two to blame, you'd be more inclined to blame them. But the elevator company presented enough evidence that the hospital was involved in the maintenance of this so that somebody from the hospital could just as easily have been negligent in their maintenance of the elevator as the specialists who came in from the elevator company. Question: why didn't the plaintiff include the hospital as another defendant? and simply say, well, maybe it was the hospital, maybe it was the elevator company, but one of the two of them was negligent and caused my injury.
I don't know for sure, but I would guess that she's employed there.
She is employed there. Why is that a barrier? People sue their employers all the time, after all.
If she's able to place the blame on someone else, then be able to take the job.
Well, again, people sue their employers over, you know, discrimination, harassment, you know, so forth. Mr. Stubbs?
Well, I'm wondering how much this is worth. I mean, especially injured, but, I mean, is she paraplegic? Or, I mean, if it's a small amount, it's not worth it. Know, risking your job later on.
$75,000 is a small amount?
No, that's a large enough amount that I would sue my employer.
Okay.
Well, if she was to sue both, wouldn't that automatically give up number two? She wouldn't have a race issue. It would prove that no one had exclusive control just in their claim.
This is actually sort of an unsettled area of the law. I make reference in the notes to a case called Ibarra, where there's a multiplicity of defendants, but there's another problem here. Mr. Ortiz?
Is it possibly because very little evidence back up prove negligence straight out on the test?
But wouldn't it be nice to be able to just put these two defendants in the dock and make them sort of fight amongst themselves? Mr. Rubio?
Well, she has filed, but she is under contract with her employer for her workers. Claim finding no fault.
Right. Remember that if you get injured on the job, your remedy for that is through the workers' comp system. And it's sort of a little digression here that the workers' comp system is sort of an alternative way of dealing with injuries compared to the tort system. The tort system looks to who's at fault, and it offers a relatively full range of damages. It's not an exact science, but we don't place any sort of artificial limits. The workers' comp system doesn't look to fault. You get injured on the job even if it's your own stupidity. You weren't looking where you were going. You did something careless. You still recover workers' comp benefits. The employer has to pay for the cost of injuries the employees receive on the job. The good news for the employer is that the benefits are limited. They're typically wage replacement, medical expenses, and the employer can ask for a determination of whether or not the continued claim of injury is really work-related. The theory of the workers' comp system was that workers would be better off in this so-called no-fault system getting prompt, no questions asked compensation, even though a limited amount, compared to throwing them to the mercies of the tort system with all of its complex machinery and procedural stuff and the very real possibility that the worker wouldn't be able to prove fault and get nothing. So you have these two systems that are kind of, and one of the things that's going on with respect to the tort system is that people say that the tort system for things like automobile accidents spends way too much money on things that don't matter, like proving fault, and not enough money actually compensating people. You're probably familiar with all the asbestos claims. Every once in a while I'll see something on TV about mesothelioma, you know, and the 800 number you can call if you or someone you love has been injured and so forth. Well, you know, the asbestos claims were studied by the I think it was the Rand Corporation 10 or 15 years ago. And they looked at the whole range of, you know, sort of the processing costs. You've got lawyers, you've got judges, you've got insurance companies, you've got all these sort of different people involved in processing asbestos claims, and they added up all the money spent on asbestos claims, and for every dollar that was spent, the injured victim wound up with 17 cents. And the other 83 cents went to all the administrative overhead in processing these claims. And a lot of people would say, let's cut out the middleman, let's have something like workers' comp, and even if it's a reduced benefit, we'd be better off to get it in real time and without paying all these blanky blank lawyers. Now, your enthusiasm for that may change as you join the side of those on the gravy train. But inquiring minds want to know, you know, what is to be praised about the workers' comp system? What about it, you know, one of the difficulties or one of the things that would slow your enthusiasm is many of you yourselves have been involved in workers' comp claims, either from the employer side or from the employee side, and it's not some prompt, no questions asked payment scheme. There's lots of litigation about workers' comp. It's turned into a litigious system of its own. The standards are different, the criteria are different, but it's not as though, thank God, the lawyers have been cut out of the action. So, again, when is it that we want something that is a no-fault, straight-up kind of compensation system, and when do we want the process of ascertaining, okay, who really is at fault, where there's a meaningful standard about determining who's at fault. And again, in auto comp, in some jurisdictions, I think Massachusetts is one of the leading ones, it has a so-called no-fault compensation system. They're really not so much a no-fault system as they are a kind of no-liability system. They say, in effect, up to a certain threshold, the costs of an auto accident, at least in terms of medical costs, the injured victim is expected to provide themselves. So you have this HIP coverage, personal injury protection coverage, where you recover from your own insurance company, and only when you hit a certain threshold do you then claim against the other driver. And again, you have these sort of hybrid systems where part of the system is so-called no fault, and then you have part of the system that's classic fault-based system. Again, people differ and they're always full of ideas as to how we might improve the system. And again, it's sort of an open, ongoing question. But short answer to the question, why did the plaintiff sue her employer? The answer is she couldn't. The statute setting up the workers' comp system says the employer has to pay this schedule of benefits, but in exchange for that, the employer is made immune from ordinary tort suits. We'll pick this question up again in Chapter 4 when we talk about immunity and the scope of this immunity. But again, it's one of those little oddities here where we can't quite follow the thing to its logical conclusion. There is this problem of the workers' comp immunity. Yeah?
Under the situation, was the plaintiff required to receive workers' comp?
Typically, the statute, there are some jurisdictions that have a sort of election process where the worker can say, I either want my workers' comp benefits or I will forego them and opt for a traditional tort remedy. But that's pretty rare, and you can understand why. From the employer standpoint, it's the worst of both worlds. You know, I have to pay when it's the employee's own stupid fault, or the employee thinks they can nail me with it. I have to pay all these, you know, enhanced kind of benefits. So what's the use of giving the worker the best of both worlds? If I were the employer, I'd like that too. But most jurisdictions, the vast majority of them, make it an exclusive remedy for those cases of accidental injury as distinguished from some intentional harm you know, discrimination in the way I ask you. Mr. Ortiz?
In situations where an employer requests that a employee sign a document contract stating that they'll take them to arbitration, does that also not allow them to go to the remedy?
Well, typically the workers' comp statute sets up a mandatory system that covers everybody and doesn't leave it to the employer and employee to work out their own deal. You know, it might be to the employee's advantage to say, I don't want workers' comp coverage. For example, I heard a statistic, I never tracked it down, but it sounded plausible, that in the logging industry around here, the average cost to the employer for a logger was like $5 an hour. That the injuries in the logging industry were so common, and the cost to the employer to get workers' comp coverage was about, you know, was very close to the hourly wage. And you can imagine the employees saying, oh, fend for myself. Give me the coverage, you know, give me the what you would otherwise have to pay for workers' comp coverage. I'd rather get paid twice as much and be a little more careful. But you can't do that. Again, from a societal standpoint, whether we're being paternalistic, you know, keeping people from themselves, or whether we're being suitably protective of vulnerable people and preventing them from being exploited in their desperation to get a job, they agree to things they don't really want. You know, that again, that's a whole societal struggle about how much you want the government intervening for your benefit and how much you want the government to leave you alone. So, again, sort of large issues. Okay, again, back to the elevator company. They were successful in showing that that they didn't have exclusive control, that somebody else could have caused this injury, could have been in the hospital, and the plaintiff's not able to complete the circle here. The plaintiff can't bring the hospital in as another defendant, and so the court says, I'm sorry, you're not entitled to a res ipsa loquitur inference. Without that, the plaintiff couldn't point to anything specific. The plaintiff's guessing, well, it might have been this, it might have been that, but at the time, the elevator suddenly drops as she's getting out. She falls. The immediate aftermath is trying to take care of her and, you know, attend to her injuries. And any evidence that, you know, whether it was dust that was in the contact points or somebody that dropped a screwdriver that jammed or whatever it was that actually caused this thing, we'll never know. So when the plaintiff can't persuade the jury that this was a result of negligence, the jury finds for the defendant. Okay? Further.
It's my understanding that the application of
well, I mean, the judge's, it's the judge's determination as to whether the elements have been satisfied to make this an appropriate case to submit to the jury. And there's actually a little bit of dispute on this point as to how the thing is handled procedurally. Some jurisdictions view the res ipsa inference as a kind of a crutch, if you will, for the plaintiff to get the case to the jury. But it's still the plaintiff's job. Other jurisdictions view the plaintiff, if the plaintiff satisfies the elements of the test, the burden is actually shifted to the defendant. So the defendant now bears the burden of essentially unproving the inference of negligence by showing that there was some other force that caused the injury, that it was due to something not attributable to them. And so it's kind of a, you know, is the glass half empty or is the glass half full? The point is, whichever way you go on that, The jury has to come to a conclusion in this particular case. Either we are persuaded that this particular injury resulted from negligence, recognizing that we may be engaging in a certain amount of speculation here, or based on the evidence, we reach the conclusion that no, it probably wasn't a result of negligence. And therefore, we find for the defendant rather than for the plaintiff. But the judge is the one who's the gatekeeper before it gets to the jury. The judge has to say, has the plaintiff played the game here to give us the three elements we need? Again, just as sort of a larger thing about using legal rules in the IRAC method, some rules operate in the conjunctive. You have to have A, B, and C, 1, 2, and 3. Any one of them that's missing and you're out. Other rules operate in a kind of looser fashion. These are criteria to consider. We're not going to be insistent that every single one of them be met. We're just going to sort of offer them for your consideration. So, in that respect, of the tools that I've given you, the plaintiff could rely on res ipsa, the plaintiff could rely on, you know, a statutory violation, could rely on a rule book, but, you know, there are different ways to skin the cat. This is a case in which it is 1, 2, and 3, and a failure on any one of these points dooms the plaintiff's argument in favor of res ipsa. So, one thing to keep track of as you memorize these rules, am I talking about something which is in the conjunctive, all of these have to be met, or is this something, as we'll see when we get to strict liability, where I throw a bunch of things out for your consideration, or maybe in the alternative? You can prove this, or you can prove that. Different ways to skin the cat. You need to go poetic on you. Okay. Other questions about res ipsa before we
take a break here?
Yeah.
Can you name multiple defendants together? And
oh, good point. Ibarra. The Ibarra case that's cited in the notes involved a patient who went into an operation. When he came out of the operation, he had suffered some nerve damage because apparently somebody wasn't paying attention, and when he was placed on the operating table, a hard object was underneath his shoulder, and while he was anesthetized, circulation was cut off and he suffered permanent nerve damage. His problem was he couldn't identify as between the surgeon, the anesthesiologist, the nurse, etc., who it was that stuck this object under his shoulder. He could definitely satisfy this element. It was a type of accident that doesn't occur except where there's negligence. He certainly wasn't responsible for it. But the defendants argued, well, we're not in exclusive control. And the court said in Ibarra, well, that's okay. We'll treat these people as kind of a collective entity. Now, in one sense, that blows the whole game. If I walk out in the morning and see that somebody's sideswiped my car, I can't go down to Superior Court and file a complaint listing all of the licensed drivers in Spokane. There's one of you out there. And you figure out which one. But in this case, the court said that's okay. Now, I would suggest that the reason it worked in Ibarra was because of the relationship among the defendants. They really are a team. And the court's belief that by placing the burden on the defendants, they were in a better position, having been there, to say, oh, well, I know, I didn't move the patient. I do remember that the nurses, you know, at one point didn't like the table wasn't raising, lowering, so they put him on a different table. What, there's something that will come out in the course of the testimony that will allow these people to sort out who caused the problem. I think in Murphy, if it weren't for the employer's immunity, if, for example, the person who was injured by this elevator was a patient who could sue the hospital and the elevator company, because of the relationship between them, I think the court would have said, fine, this is like Ibarra. They're contractually related. However, I don't think you can use this where the parties are unrelated. They don't have any, and their activity is sufficiently separated in time so that it isn't logical to kind of lump them together and say, you guys sort it out. But I'm just sort of guessing there. Ibarra stands as an anomaly from the usual requirement that a defendant have exclusive control, and I think the way to reconcile Ibarra with the other cases is where the defendants essentially act as a collective entity. They're legally separate. As you may know, doctors come into hospitals not as employees of the hospital, but as independent contractors. And the whole economics of that relationship is interesting in and of itself. But whereas, you know, you think of this team as essentially one happy family, in fact, they are distinct legal entities. But again, the court in Ibarra recognized it made a certain amount of sense to treat them as though they were a collective entity. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break and come back.